We went to the Healing of Agape this week, and today we have with us again Dr. Dean Radden to talk about his new book, Entangled Minds. How are you, Dean?
I'm fine. How are you?
Thanks for coming back on the show. I'm so glad to have you.
Thank you.
So, this is your new book. Is it out on the shelf yet?
It should be on shelves in all bookstores and also in the online bookstore.
What is that, the one on Noetic Sciences?
No, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you name it.
Okay, good.
All bookstores.
Okay. So, first of all, we know this book is about to focus on the proof of consciousness. Why don't we define, first of all, what is your definition in this book of consciousness and your definition of unconscious, so we'll know where we are.
Actually, I talk a little bit about consciousness in this book, but that's not really the focus. In fact, I'm talking about experience. It all starts from experience, and by experience I particularly mean awareness. So in a larger sense, I'm talking about that portion of consciousness which includes being aware of what's happening inside your head.
Okay. Do you think, does action at a distance occur over a field unlike a physical field, or by what are they mediated?
Well, that's the question. One of the reasons for writing this book is because when you look at the evidence for psychic phenomena, and I'm talking about both stories in people's lives, the anecdotes, of which there are probably millions, and also the scientific studies that have tried to see whether or not these effects are what they appear to be. When you look at the whole history of this data, and I cover this in a couple of chapters in the book, a very, very strong case can be made that these effects are real. They're not always very strong, and they're not always highly reliable, but nevertheless, they do occur sometimes. And over the course of the past century, when people have been trying to understand what does this mean, what's the medium in which these things are supported, the first way that people ask questions and try to get an explanation is based, not surprisingly, on common sense. And so if you're thinking in terms of a common sense universe, in order to get something, just take for example something like telepathy. The experience might be that one day you wake up and you're thinking of an old friend you haven't spoken to in 20 years, and they just come to mind for some reason, and they're on your mind and on your mind, and you go to work and the phone rings and there they are, and they're calling you for some reason. Perhaps they had you on their mind also. So this is not a simple coincidence, because it's extremely unlikely that both of you out of the blue would begin to think about each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are possible explanations for why such a thing might happen. Maybe you're both watching a television show and had something on it which reminded you of college, and you both started thinking about each other and so on. So you can begin to analyze why certain coincidences occur. But there are many cases where these kinds of connections occur where there's no discernible reason at all. And it certainly doesn't feel like a coincidence. It feels like something really strong has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the experience. So common sense would say that maybe the way that this works is the same way that a cell phone works. Well, how does a cell phone work? It involves taking information from one place and tracing through space to find the other place, the other phone, and then sending signals from one to the other. That's a common sense way of thinking of the sequence of action that must occur in order to get information from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
There have been many attempts to take that kind of model and apply it to these phenomena, and basically they don't work. They don't work experimentally, and they don't even work very well logically. In trying to figure out how can you find your friend where you don't even know where they are, and many other similar problems. So sometimes, and what I'm talking about, by the way, is the way that physicists or engineers tend to think of these things. If you happen to be a psychologist, you won't worry too much about the physics of it, but you'll worry a lot about the psychological aspects of, well, why this particular friend? And what is the impact of this experience on you? And if you happen to be a theologian, you'll think about it perhaps in spiritual terms and so on. Everybody thinks about these things from their own perspective.
Mm-hmm.
What I've tried to do then in the book is to talk about, from a wide variety of perspectives, how do we begin to understand this in a way that actually makes sense and is consistent with both the anecdotes and what we see in experiments. And the bottom line is that when you ask the same kind of questions for a century, and you don't get very far in understanding what's going on, then maybe you're asking the wrong questions.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's not the case that when I think of an old friend and they call me, it's not that my mind reached out to them somehow and found them and caused them to think of me and caused they then called me back. It's not that kind of a sequential, logical sequence. But rather, it's we need to turn the question on its head, and it's not how did information from me get to the other person, but rather why do I think that anything went, that any signal or forces or energy or anything
mm-hmm.
went from A to B? Perhaps another way of thinking of it is, well, maybe A and B are always connected. It's always the same thing in a sense. It's as though they're in the same place, but they don't appear to be at the same place. What would that be like? It would be something like you and your friend, from the moment you met, you handed each other a walkie-talkie that had an open line 24 hours a day to each other. And even though you separated and you went on your separate ways many years later, that walkie-talkie was still there and it was still going. But you just didn't pay much attention to it because you were involved in other things. Nevertheless, in the background, you're always having this channel open to things that are happening with your friend, and it's here all the time, in both directions. So then one day, you think of your friend, you might be talking to them, their name might come up, something sparks your interest in them, and as this is occurring to you, it is also occurring to them, because the walkie-talkie is open.
Mm-hmm.
The information is there all the time, in which case, if you're at a cocktail party, which is noisy, and somebody across the other end of the room happens to mention your name, even though it's very noisy, you will still hear your name.
Yes, that's true.
Why does that happen? It happens because there are certain aspects of our unconscious attention that is paying attention to things of importance, one of which is your name. And when that occurs, and it hears this unconscious scanning mechanism, hears your name, it will bring it to your conscious awareness. So in this case, your walkie-talkie has picked up something about your friend of interest, has brought it to your awareness, you begin to think about them. Whatever it was that brought it to your awareness is likely to bring to your friend's awareness as well. And that's the reason, the ultimate reason, why both of you end up thinking about each other and making a phone call. It's because you're both connected or interconnected all the time. So this is not simply the case for people you happen to run into. It also appears to be the case, based on what we know in physics now, that virtually everything on the Earth and probably beyond is already very deeply interconnected. And this is because we have all exchanged our atoms many times over the course of Earth's history. And so from a physics point of view, we are literally entangled with each other. Now, whether this extends beyond the Earth, we don't know yet, but there's every reason to believe that it would, in which case, you can keep going with this idea. After a while, you begin to see how we are all physically entangled, possibly, with the universe at large, in which case, the only reason that we're not paying attention to what's going on in Pluto and some other galaxy is because it's as though those walkie-talkies are open, we're connected to them, but either the information we're getting doesn't have any meaning, or we're simply more interested in what's going on near us,
mm-hmm.
so we don't have any reason to pay attention to it.
Now, these walkie-talkies that we're talking about, the ability for them to communicate doesn't diminish with any kind of distance, does it?
And not only does it not diminish with distance in space, it also doesn't diminish with distance in time.
Now, tell us what you mean by that.
Well, here's where we have a bit of a problem, in that the cell phone analogy works pretty well for space, because we all are pretty comfortable with the idea that any cell phone can reach any other cell phone around the world through space. But the kind of entanglements we're talking about are from the quantum world, and these entanglements transcend space and time. They're not part of the three dimensions of space and one of time. They're somewhere else. Either they exist in some other dimension, which physicists are now talking about in other dimensions, or it exists completely outside of dimensional structures altogether.
Now,
so,
are you saying that these cell phones can call in the past and in the future?
Yes.
Okay.
That the connection to another person, say, as an analogy, that your connection with another person transcends both space and time. It is connected through a medium that has no space or time. The reason why we can't talk about it very easily is because our language assumes a flow of time. Our language is linear. We have to speak the words in a sequential fashion. We have things like tenses that tell us where in time we're talking about and so on. It's extremely difficult for us to even articulate what it would mean to be able to communicate through time, but that is precisely what these connections mean.
Now let's talk a minute about coherent state. So for the listeners, why don't you first of all define what is a coherent state? Give an example of what of lack of coherence. How would somebody recognize that?
Well, I'll tell you the vernacular way of thinking of it, because the technical explanation requires mathematics. So in the vernacular, everybody knows that if you're at a football or baseball stadium and somebody starts the wave, where people stand up and then you stand up and the people next to you stand up and so on, from a distance it looks like there's a wave moving through the audience,
mm-hmm.
spectators. When the audience is working together and this wave persists around the stadium, perhaps a couple times, that's a kind of coherence, both in the movement and the sequence and the attention and then the behavior of the people. They're all working together in some precise way. An incoherent state is perhaps people coming out of a train and all going back to their car. What you see from a distance is people spilling out of the doors and sort of going all over the place.
Okay.
So there doesn't appear to be much agreement or coherent pattern to what people are doing.
So do you think that this the ability to communicate on these cell phones have something to do with mind coherence? In other words, I guess that would be being in the moment more. Does that make sense?
Well, there's two aspects to your question. One is, what makes the connections more evident? What makes them stronger?
Mm-hmm.
And another question is, where do those connections come from in the first place? Like, how do you establish the connection?
Right.
So I'll answer that one first. How do you establish the connection? You don't. Because the connections are always there. It's simply the way that the universe is constructed. So we live in a medium in which everything is connected at some deep level. So you don't have to connect anything. How do you make it better? My guess is that the reason why we get these experiences at all, why we have psychic experience, is because of our attention. And so the thing that distinguishes one person from another in terms of psychic talent is their ability to be able to attend to the thing of interest. So this may be one of the reasons why historically one of the features of learning how to meditate, which of course is an attention training system, one of the features of it is that after you meditate for a while, you begin to spontaneously experience telepathy, clairvoyance, all of the other psychic effects. People will experience them at different times in their meditation and training and to different degrees, but almost everyone will end up having these experiences as a result of their learning how to place their attention on what they wish to look at. So that's how you make it better.
You have a mechanism. For example, you're familiar with David Hawkins' work, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about his mechanism for qualifying or maybe even quantifying self-awareness? Because, you know, the tests that seem to be performed, they decline in the effects sometimes. And I think that maybe, you know, people go in and out of coherence. What do you think about the thought of using some kind of mechanism like Hawkins' work to quantify somebody's coherence in performing these tests so that you have a better output reply?
You're talking about his method of kinesiology,
mm-hmm.
muscle testing?
That?
Yeah, that's one method. There are many other methods that can be used, including performance tests, to measure, to quantify how well somebody's doing. So, the answer is just one method. Some people appear to be good at using the muscle testing, and others are not so good.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a mechanism that you use?
Well, I'm an experimentalist, so I tend to rely on performance measures. What that means is if I want somebody to do some clairvoyance for me, then I will calibrate them before they do the clairvoyance task that I'm interested in by having them do a clairvoyance task that I'm not so interested in, but it will allow me to see whether or not they're hot today. Because, as you said, people have hot periods and cold periods, and the reason why the performance fluctuates is probably the same reason why even Olympic athletes, their performance will fluctuate from one day to the next. We're not like machines that can perform exactly the same way each time. We will perform differently depending on how much sleep we got and what we ate and who's around us and what's on our mind and all kinds of things.
Because I think that maybe is why some of hard science doesn't want to believe us, because it's not perfect all the time.
Well, it is sometimes that's the reason why they look askance at these phenomena. But if they just spend 2 minutes thinking about why sports are interesting, and they'll realize that the human performance is extremely variable, even at the Olympic level. So to imagine that this should be any less variable when we're dealing with a subtle mental ability is just silly. Of course it would be. It'd be just as variable.
Let's talk a little bit about your GANS, your Cy and the GANS field chapter. That was a really interesting chapter, your Jack and Jill description.
Mm-hmm.
Where you had them in the different rooms, and you had those people in rooms that were guarded from any kind of electromagnetics, didn't you? How did you have that set up?
Well, I've done many of these tests, but in that chapter and that number of the other chapters, I talk more about what is done in general. I talk about, because the name of the game in science is not simply that I can get an interesting result, but that independent groups over many years can get similar results.
Mm-hmm.
That gives us higher confidence that we're dealing with something real. So the general idea is that if you're going to test telepathy, you have to make absolutely sure that there's no ordinary way in which two people can communicate. So this means you need to isolate them so they can't use their cell phone to call each other, and they can't hear each other, and they can't see each other, and all the rest of it. And oftentimes what you do then is to put one or both people into rooms which are designed to be both electromagnetically shielded and sometimes magnetically shielded as well, and certainly acoustically shielded. And what this does is it means that when they're in their rooms, they are blocked from each other so that they can't transmit messages in the usual way.
You did experiments with these people where you had them view, one person would sit there and the other person would view pictures. And you would get a response from the person that was sitting alone based on what the other person was seeing on the computer screen.
Right. Right.
What kind of pictures were they looking at, and what kind of responses were they getting, and what does that mean to the world? What is that telling us?
Well, there are three kinds of responses. In the Ganzfeld test, the person who's receiving the information, the nominal receiver, is asked to speak aloud anything that comes to mind, all of their thoughts. So you have to learn how to do this. You have to any fleeting thought going through your head, you just speak it aloud. And meanwhile, the sender, person who's trying to send the information, is at a distance and typically looking at a photograph or looking at a video clip, typically about 1 minute long. And they'll see the same video clip again and again over 30 minutes. The point of that experiment is that the receiver will begin to experience the content of the picture or the video clip that the sender is looking at, and they'll begin to speak it aloud. So that's that form of response. That's a conscious response. The second kind of response is that the receiver is simply relaxing while some aspect of their physiological state is being looked at. This might be their heart rate, it might be their skin conductance, it might be their brain waves, it could be the respiration, it could be blood pressure, and sometimes all five of those at the same time. And they're just asked to relax and to think about their distant partner. Well, the distant partner, the sender in this case, is seated in front of one of two types of stimuli. Most of the time, the TV monitor is dark and nothing's happening. But every so often, for typically 10 to 20 seconds, the TV monitor will turn on with the live video image of the receiver. And that's a signal for the sender to try to mentally grab the receiver and shake them, to arouse them so that they'll feel something at a distance. And then the TV screen will go blank again, and the sender is asked to withdraw their attention. So that's one type of stimulus they could use. And of course, the hope in this experiment is that during those short periods, randomly selected periods, when the video comes on, that the receiver will, in fact, respond to the sender who's trying to grab them and shake them a little bit. And we can see that through a change in heart rate or change in skin conductance and so on. The third type of test is that the sender sees a 1 or 2 minute emotional video. So, and will try to convey the emotions to the distant receiver. And so if, for example, you're looking at a 1 or 2 minute very happy, upbeat video that's designed to make you happy, and you try to send your happiness to the receiver, and then you hope that the receiver will respond by perhaps their heart rate going up or some other change. So these are three different kinds of studies looking at both conscious and unconscious ways of the receiver responding and different ways of stimulating the sender. All of them, of course, are done under conditions where the receiver has no idea when the sender is trying to do their thing. And in many cases, also, the sender doesn't know in advance, and nor does the experimenter. So these are called double-blind, sometimes triple-blind experiments, because either two or three of the people involved don't know in advance when the stimulus periods are going to be. So they can't accidentally outguess what's about to happen.
What did you find when you did this in each one of those test studies?
In each one of the tests, you find very consistent results. For when the receiver is asked to speak aloud, to be consciously aware of what somebody else is thinking or experiencing, on average, over thousands of repeated tests, they can do that. They don't do it 100% of the time, but they do it far beyond chance. For the unconscious responses, the physiological tests, there is strong evidence, highly statistically significant evidence, that skin conductance changes, that heart rate changes, the blood pressure and EEG and respiration, they all change when the sender is trying to engage them mentally. So they're all consistent in the sense that if you're separated from a partner and your partner is trying to grab your attention or send you information, that in fact the receiver will get the information beyond, way beyond chance to, in some cases, quintillions to one. You know, it's millions to one odds against chance, and billions and trillions and quadrillions and so on. You can keep going as far as you want. The odds against chance that of the results that we see are so far from chance that basically chance is not a viable explanation.
And I don't think you're saying that someone's going to jump up and say, I've got the message, I hear them. I think energy is subtle, and so what you're getting, finding, are subtle responses from the body, right?
That's correct. The effects that we see are relatively small in magnitude. In fact, almost always small in magnitude. Not always. Sometimes you get an amazing result. Like sometimes you will get a receiver who describes exactly what is happening to the sender as it is happening to the sender. It does happen, but it's pretty rare. More often what you get is that the sender's physiological response or the sender's conscious response are influenced by the sender in some way, and that's what can be detected. So that these tend to be subtle responses, but they're not chance responses.
So whether it's subtle or not, it's still a response, and it's still an affirmative that it's real.
Right.
And I think what you're saying in the long run is, when it comes to overall consciousness, is what we think, regardless of whether we believe it or not, affects the entire world in some manner, even though it might be subtle, right?
Well, if it works between two people, then what's to prevent it from working with three people or 10 people or everyone? And the answer is we don't know any reason why it wouldn't work for everyone all the time. It doesn't, I mean, it's not as though you go into the laboratory and suddenly some people are psychic. We're seeing effects that must exist in the real world all the time. And so while we may not be aware of it, in fact, most people, I think, are not aware of it most of the time. People we call psychic or intuitives are ones who are simply more aware of the fact that these kinds of connections exist all the time.
And your word for this, I guess, foundation is psi, right?
Psi is a general term used for all forms of psychic experience, yes.
Mm-hmm. And can it be detected unconsciously in your autonomic or your nervous system?
Sure.
Is that how this is happening?
Yep.
Tell us about that. Gut feelings, maybe?
Yep. And
is that what that, you know how when you get stopped by a police officer and you get that kind of funny sick feeling in your stomach when you see that blue light, is that indicative of that gut feeling?
Nope, then it's too late. You probably will get a sinking feeling in your stomach, but that's due to an emotional rush.
I see, so that's a consequence of what happened.
Yeah, whereas if 10 minutes before the police officer stops you, you have a sense that, you know what, there's a curve up ahead, I just have a feeling there's going to be a cop on the road, and so you slow down today. Normally you'd be zooming past that point. Mm-hmm. You slow down, and sure enough, there's a cop waiting, and you would have gotten the ticket if you had not paid attention to the feeling that you had. Well, so that's what I'm calling a gut feeling. That's your intuitive hit, that there's something that doesn't feel quite right on that road today. Now, of course, in real life, it's very difficult to know, is that psychic or was it an inference? Maybe the weather was bad and you figure that the police would be more concerned about people speeding in a certain area, so you figured it out. That certainly will happen sometimes. But there are also times when it's a perfectly clear day, there hasn't been a cop on this road for months as far as you can remember, and today you're just driving along and suddenly you get a feeling. You had better slow down. You slow down, 5 minutes later, there it is. That tends to be more like a psychic hit because there wasn't any obvious reason that you could have figured it out.
And how do you measure this with the electrogastrogram?
Right. There is an instrument called an electrogastrogram that you put electrodes over the stomach or near the belly button, and it measures the electrophysiology of the gut. What's going on in your gut is primarily peristalsis. It's the muscular action of your digestive system that keeps the food being pushed down or pushed through your system.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, the signal, the electrical signal associated with that, looks very much like an EEG. Looks like a brainwave, except it's much, much slower. So a brainwave might be vibrating along at 10 cycles per second, whereas your gut is vibrating along at 20 seconds per cycle. So it's much, much slower, but the essence of it looks very much like a brainwave.
And you use the experiments to show angry and sad and happy and songs that were happy and upbeat and songs that were more sad and quiet in your experiment. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of findings did you find with that?
Well, because of the relationship between emotions and the gut, as you said, if you were speeding and you're stopped by a police officer, then your stomach sinks because of the emotional rush. The stomach is exquisitely sensitive to emotions. And so we thought that if we're trying to measure an effect in the gut itself, then maybe the distant partner should be trying to send emotions towards you. So that's how we did the experiment. We manipulated the sender's emotions from happy to neutral to sad to angry and so on to see whether those emotions would cause a different reaction in the receiver. And we did find that the receiver's gut behaved differently as there were different emotions being experienced by the distant sender.
And you would have like peaks and valleys on that machine print out. Is that how it reflected?
Well, you see a cycle that's about 20 seconds per cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks a little bit like a noisy sine wave, and that's what's actually happening in the gut. And so we looked at the peak differences between a neutral condition where there was no emotion versus one of the highly emotional conditions in the receiver's gut. And that's how we're able to see that there was a difference.
Interesting. Now, a lot of people in the mainstream think that people that have these experiences, that something is wrong with them psychologically, that they have some kind of disassociative behavior.
Mm-hmm.
What have you found in your studies that have to do with either some kind of psychological sickness versus someone who believes in size as opposed to someone who believes in some kind of fundamental religion that doesn't believe in this kind of stuff?
Well, that's about a five-hour question. let's see. There is something called schizotypal behavior. We all like to think that we're perfectly normal, but everybody can be rated on a scale to the degree to which they exhibit schizotypal behavior. On the far end of the scale, we have people who are literally schizophrenic. These are very high schizotypal behavior. On the low end, you have people who with very low schizotypal behavior, but nevertheless, everyone has a little bit. So one of the characteristics, one of the diagnostic tools for determining whether somebody is pathologically schizophrenic is that they will report very strong psychic experiences. They will report hearing voices in their head, and they will have the sense that these voices are actual people, oftentimes trying to get them to do things they don't want to do. They will think of themselves and feel themselves as being the world's greatest telepathic receiver. They will have a sense that what they think is caused in the world. They can cause things to happen at a distance. So this is a very common thing among schizophrenics. And I'm contacted all the time by people who claim that they're the best psychic ever, because they're always 100% right, and their thoughts are immediately reflected in the world at large. And one of the first questions I will ask someone like that is, how long has it been since you've taken your medication? And believe it or not, I would say about 80% of the time they will say, oh, I haven't taken it in 3 or 4 weeks. And this is because it's very predictable that if someone is having extremely strong psychic abilities, or their perception is it's extremely strong, the likelihood is that they're schizophrenic and they know it, and they simply stop taking their medication.
Now, does that mean, is their information truly psychic, or is something going on in there's some kind of firing problem going on in their brain?
This is a very good question. It's a very good question, and it has not been studied systematically, because when somebody is in this state, it would be great, it would be really interesting to actually use them in experiments to find out, are they really psychic or not? But that wouldn't be ethical, because the vast majority of the time, somebody who's going through this, they want to turn it off. They can't function because they're hearing voices, and they're being buffeted about by emotions that they can't see, and they lose the sense of who they are, and they don't know whose ego is whom, and it's a horrible state to be in. So the main thing that they want to do, and the main thing that is ethical to do, is to make it stop. And that's what the drugs are good for. They're sedatives. They tend to turn this stuff off. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if schizophrenics are perhaps extremely sensitive psychics who just for some reason or another can't turn it off, maybe because of biochemical changes or neuronal differences or something of that sort.
So what about the people that go to the opposite end of the spectrum?
On the opposite end of the spectrum, the low schizotypal behavior, you will have people who never report anything psychic ever. They never have strange coincidences. They have a very firm grip on reality here and now, and they may never even think about the fact that these things are possible. From their perspective, people who, otherwise normal people, who can talk about these things are probably crazy because it's not part of their experience. It's not the way that they exist in the world. So it's sometimes used the story of the one-sighted person among the land of the blind. If everyone was blind, but you could see what you would describe to other people, they would say that you're crazy. It's not possible to do that. So you're confused. You're imagining things. You're hallucinating. So I think we need to have a certain degree of sympathy for people who never have these experiences because from their point of view, everyone else is nuts. Then you have the people in the middle. And the people in the middle are probably about 60% of the population. These are the folks who have some degree of schizotypal behavior. What it means, that the word has a negative connotation, which is unfortunate, but all it means is that there are some characteristics of full-blown schizophrenia that you can have, and yet you're also perfectly normal and stable and high-functioning. So, for example, if you take a creative population like artists or musicians, especially musicians who tend to who compose, they will show very strong schizotypal behavior. You know, they'll talk about hearing things in their head or seeing things if they're a visual artist, but it's not uncontrolled. They go into fantasy states or they go into reverie in order to compose or in order to figure out what they want to paint, and they can evoke it. And so they're creating the state that a schizophrenic is not able to control. Those people, these creative populations, tend to be much more psychic, not only in terms of what they believe and what they report in their experience, but in the laboratory too. They perform at much higher levels than people who are not so creative. So that suggests to us that maybe it really is true that the schizophrenics who are having trouble keeping themselves grounded, some or maybe all of the information which is impinging on them is in fact psychic. They're just, to use the metaphor we were talking about before with cell phones, it's as though they, like everyone else, has 400 cell phones on them all the time, but they're all turned up very loud and they can't discriminate from one to the other. So they're just constantly in this cacophony of noise and they want to turn it off. Whereas a creative artist also has a couple hundred cell phones, but they can turn them on selectively, and that's what the difference is.
Now, do you think that that's maybe one of the reasons that science doesn't take it serious, that they think that the people that do it are just schizophrenic?
It certainly has been one of the reasons why scientists has been very suspicious, because people typically making the strongest claims, and I'm talking about claims of typically 100% accurate, those kinds of claims are simply not true. Or at least, they may be true, but the people who tend to say those claims tend to be pretty high up on the pathological scale. And so, of course, anybody would become very suspicious if it turns out that all the people claiming very strong psychic ability are also verifiably pathological. Then you can very easily get the idea that, well, it's all pathological. And that's a mistake, but it's understandable why that occurs.
You talked about some work that Bill Rowe was doing on group energies. What evidence do you have that there is a collective group consciousness?
that Bill Rohl was doing.
Yeah, he was doing some work using a hidden random number generator with some athletes.
Right. That was...
Yeah, Olympic hockey team.
Huh? Yeah, William Rowe, that's right. This is part of a class of experiments called field consciousness experiments. And it assumes that just as you can have a telepathic connection to another person, that there is a way in which more than two minds can interact in some way. So a group can have the equivalent of a common or collective mind. So this method started, the way to detect whether there is such a thing, there are a number of ways, but the way that's been used in the past 15 years or so has been to put in the vicinity of a group something that measures the degree of coherence in a physical system. So the easiest way of doing that is to take a physical system, which is random, and to look for changes in the randomness over time. So you simply put that into a room where there's a group that is doing something,
mm-hmm.
something that is mentally coherent, and at times also mentally not coherent. And if you do this, and it turns out that when the group becomes mentally coherent, meaning this is typically a felt sense, like I played in orchestras for many years, and there were times when everybody who was playing knew, you could feel it happen, that the whole thing just gels.
Mm, and it
feels good, it sounds different to the audience, it's as though everything is just perfect. You can't not play perfectly. And you see this in sports teams. You see this anytime there are groups that get together. Sometimes there's an amazing flow that occurs. So during those periods when there's this amazing coherence in the group, if it turns out that your randomness becomes less random, meaning more ordered, then that would show a possible connection between a collective mind and matter, a large-scale mind-matter interaction. So this sort of experiment has been done now well over 100 times by a bunch of different groups around the world. And collectively, it does show strong evidence that there is something like a collective mind. And when the collective mind, as it shifts through periods of coherence and non-coherence, it affects the world around them.
Mm-hmm. And that's how, I mean, I guess that was how... what I was referring to when I was talking about every thought that you have affects somebody somewhere, even though it's subtly, you just add it up all together, it would make a big difference in the world as it relates to peace and well-being in your own life.
If it is coherent with other thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine, for example, that it's as though, okay, so imagine that you have a whole bunch of people around a large lake. And each one is at random times throwing in a pebble and throwing it at random places in the lake. And if you were simply to look from a distance at the lake, it would just be an agitated, shimmering surface because it would be randomly jumping all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
If you tell everybody every time you hear a little bell tone to pick up a rock of a certain size and to throw it a certain distance into the lake, and they do this repeatedly, again and again and again, you will start creating a standing wave, a wave of ripples in the lake that begins to take on a certain structure. And it, because of your timing the throwing of the pebbles and the distance of the pebbles precisely among maybe thousands of people around the lake, you can build up this very complicated structure, but a stable structure in the lake itself. So this is the difference between coherent thought or coherent thought as action and non-coherent thought as action.
Very good analogy. Now, I said I wasn't going to do this, but I have to ask this one question. I was looking at Lynn McTaggart's book, The Field, today,
uh-huh.
and I was reading where she said Stuart Hameroff says that anesthetic gases turn off consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a different definition of consciousness than we're using here, or does he just simply mean he's turning off awareness?
Turning off awareness.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's a problem, because I get confused when they're using consciousness in all those different spaces. It really doesn't turn off your consciousness.
No. Most people use the word consciousness to mean conscious awareness. We know, for example, that depending on the level of which your consciousness is tuned, an anesthesiologist can take you from being aware to just below that. You can, and as you move through that state, you go through a twilight stage where you're kind of aware and you're kind of not aware at the same time, and then slightly below that, you're simply not aware anymore.
Okay. Now that kind of confused me a little bit. That term consciousness, you know, we've been talking about this, needs to be defined so that we can have intelligent conversations.
Well, as you've discovered, 50 people will have 50 slightly different versions of it. So I think it's very useful for you to ask people beforehand, what do they mean when they're talking about this term?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the things I'm trying to do with that project that I sent you, mm-hmm. to get some definitions of this so we can say, okay, today if we have 30 people around the table, we're talking about definition number 6 or definition number 5, because it's hard to get science to take us serious if we don't even have a meeting of the minds about what we're talking about here.
Right. I could say, though, that the reason why consciousness is most interesting is because of awareness. Mm-hmm. That's the mystery here. Because if we weren't aware of our own thoughts, we wouldn't be speaking right now. In fact, we wouldn't have any of this technology. We would be living in caves eating grubs for dinner.
Yeah.
There's something important and peculiar about being self-aware that makes all of this possible. And that's the reason why consciousness is such an interesting topic. Now, if you ask the average person on the street, how do you suppose that you're aware of anything? They'll think you're crazy to ask us such a question. But it turns out that it's extremely difficult to have an explanation. In fact, there is no explanation at this point that everyone agrees on. Mm-hmm. That explains how is it that we are aware of anything. This is still an outstanding problem, and a case can be made that it is the most important problem in science, because, as I said, if we were not aware, if we didn't have this peculiar property, by definition, we wouldn't be aware of anything.
Right. We'd just be sitting staring out a window.
Well, no, there would be no windows. We'd be staring at a cave.
Nobody would make them.
Yeah.
You know, have you noticed that in the last, say, decade, I guess, there's been hundreds and hundreds of books coming out, mine and yours and Bill Tiller's and Charles Tartt's, and do you suppose all of this is happening at the same time?
I think the number of books coming out on every topic has exploded.
Particularly on consciousness, because, you know, like I got my information and I put it out in my book in the kindergarten format.
Mm-hmm.
You put it out in this format. It seems that we are all getting this information at the same time. We're all getting the same information. We're just wording it, you know, on a higher or lower level of understanding. I guess we're getting what I call those drop-down informations, which mm-hmm. is coming from somewhere. Where is that coming from?
Well,
and why do you suppose it's happening right now? The collective consciousness?
If it is truly a disproportionate increase in consciousness, I'm not completely convinced of that, because just the number of books being published at all has gone significantly up. I mean, across the board, there's just a huge number of books coming out. But if there is an increase in books on consciousness, it probably is being pushed by necessity. This is a phrase that my dad always liked to use, that the reason why things happen in a big way, especially sort of bubbling up from the ground roots, is because it is necessary for it to happen. So why is it necessary now? Because the whole world is faced by this huge long list of important and earth-shattering changes that are imminent. And they require that something change. So to give just a single example, I will anger everyone who has a very large SUV or a Hummer, but nevertheless, if you imagine, look at where we are currently and what we've done as a country because of our reliance on oil and gasoline. It's a horrendous situation that we've gotten into. It's going to be even worse getting out of it. And yet, people are still driving very large SUVs. And worse, they're driving Hummers. That means that, you know, for one person to have a Hummer, it doesn't matter very much. But when those small decisions are magnified in the millions, tens of millions, it has a very significant impact on the world. So I think at some level, the world knows this. And the world is beginning to say, you know what, you better change your behavior, people on the world, because if you don't, you're all going to get wiped out. It will start over again.
You know, Edgar Mitchell told me about a friend of his named Lester Brown that wrote a book called Plan B2, I think. And based on Lester's research on salt tables and water tables and oil tables and things like that, we don't have enough resources to go beyond 2012. So maybe that's what this side field is picking up. Even though the people don't have knowledge on an individual level, you know, the people that are just living and interacting in the world, they don't realize that.
Right.
I guess some way, psi or consciousness is telling them, and so it's all coming forth.
Well, or more likely that if this is the canary in the mine issue. Not everybody is going to be sensitive to these things. Most people will go to the pump and just grumble because the price is now $3.50 a gallon, and not think about it anymore. But a small percentage of people, maybe 10 or 20% or maybe less, I don't know, will recognize that this is part of a much larger syndrome. And it really does require a very dramatic, very large-scale shift in awareness in order for things to continue. And I think, in a sense, even in order for the human species to continue in its current course, a very significant change is necessary. So maybe all the people who are publishing these books are, in essence, the canaries. You know, we're all singing as loudly as we can to try to get people's attention, because we recognize that things have to change, and it's not simply fear-mongering, it's a reflection of what is actually underway.
Do you think that information is being carried, like your experiments, from one mind to another?
I think it is, yeah. There's a kind of a mental infection that can occur in both directions. If you have a bunch of people out there who have a don't-care attitude or an attitude of fear, that will infect other minds. And so the spiritual teachers will always say that peace has to begin within, meaning you have to become peaceful. Your peace will help another person become peaceful simply by the fact that you're peaceful.
Yeah.
And if that can spread out like an infection as well, except it happens to be a positive infection.
So, Dean, we've got about 3 minutes. So what if this psi is real?
So what?
You know, what does that mean to the world?
Well, it's relevant to what we were just talking about. If it is true that minds extend and are entangled with other minds, then what we intend, what we wish, how we act, what we think, is not just limited to what's inside your head. It is something that affects what other people think, how they behave, what they intend, and so on. So this is just one of a number of important things. But I think for our daily lives, it's probably the most important. That if you're driving along the highway and somebody cuts you off and you get a flash of anger and you wish something bad about that person, this is not something that should be taken lightly, because that anger will shoot out and affect not only the person you're directing it at, but probably a lot of other people as well. And so it's conceivable that things like road rage are a kind of mental infection. And if you had taken a different tack, and rather than feeling angry, you had a flash of compassion for the other person who felt the need that they had to get somewhere quickly, and you don't know why they had to get somewhere fast, that would also have a ripple effect.
Dying in the emergency.
Yeah. Maybe that is the case. So the way that we need to be more mindful about our decisions and our thoughts, because they matter outside yourself. And it becomes, in essence, a kind of environment in which we live. So do we want to live in a polluted mental environment or a pleasant one? Well, I prefer a pleasant one.
Now, if you had one thing that you could say to the material scientist or the priesthood, as I call them, before we hang up, what would that be?
I have nothing against materialism. Science is dealt very effectively with material.
I mean about listening to this information that's being put in front of their face that they're not listening to.
I would say maybe pay attention to it. And I can say, actually, that for those who do pay attention, because many people are interested, for those who do pay attention to it, and I'm talking about scientists, they go away with the sense that at minimum something very interesting is going on. They may not buy it immediately, but they do go away thinking, that seems kind of interesting and maybe I should pay attention.
It's something worth listening to.
Right.
Dean, thanks so much for coming on my show today. I appreciate you.
You're welcome. I'll come back anytime.
I'm going to hold you to that. Agape, my friend.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.